Really, guys? I mean, you didn't see this one coming? Come on now.
Yeah, yeah, it seems like that should have been caught in the first smoke test, but alas, here we are. You know, it's
here
just
we are
to show.
Here we are talking about 20,000 accounts.
Yeah, big companies make mistakes too, so don't feel bad if you shipped a bug last week.
We're all allegedly human.
Yeah, allegedly. How you doing today, Mr. Brumley?
Hey, Chris, what's going on? I'm doing well, sir. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. I've been playing around with the new Fable 5 Mythos class LLM model released by Anthropic today. It's interesting.
Mythos class, huh?
That's what they're calling it.
How do you know it's Mythos class if none of us have ever interacted with Mythos?
Talk to their marketing department.
I got a Mythos class vehicle downstairs. It's a Honda Civic, but it's a Mythos class car because you can't prove it's not. I'm just joking. Fable 5 came out. I haven't had a chance to touch Fable 5 just yet, despite the fact that it's now more than 24 hours old. They actually have some different data retention policies than some of the other models do. So I'm waiting for them to catch up.
Yeah, I'm a little curious too, because it shows up in my enterprise account, but then I have like a home one for my side projects that I pay for, the $100 a month plan, and I can't get it in that one. So I don't know if it's only available in enterprise or if it's because that one's a Canadian account and maybe it's geofenced to the US.
Oh, I would hope not, but that's actually a valid point. I never thought about that. That might be it. I don't know. We'll have to look and see. I mean, not
can't,
that I can
can't
just
trust
hop
the
to Canada
Canadians
really
with
quick.
That kind of power, right?
That's one way of putting it, or your laws protect your citizens. That could be another way to look at it,
too. That could be another one, too. All right, got some interesting stuff today. Pulled a bunch of them from our friend Zach's Detection Engineering Weekly. So Zach Allen,
nice.
Shout out. Yeah, let's get into it, as they say. So Depth First reported that its autonomous security agent discovered 21 previously unknown vulnerabilities in FFmpeg, a widely deployed multimedia framework used across browsers, streaming infrastructure, and other systems that process media. The company positions the result as a test of its agentic security analysis capabilities, especially given that FFmpeg contains roughly 1.5 million lines of optimized C code and has already undergone extensive fuzzing and manual review over more than two decades. The article notes that recent efforts from Google's Big Sleep team and Anthropic's Mythos model had already identified security issues in FFmpeg, making additional vulnerability discovery increasingly difficult. According to Depth First, its system was able to identify 21 zero days at an estimated cost of roughly $1,000. The article contrasts the security agent with a traditional coding agent. Rather than focusing on generating application code, the security agent is described as threat modeling a code base, identifying attack surfaces, tracing data flows, validating attacker control over inputs, and confirming whether suspected vulnerabilities are actually reachable and reproducible. Depth First states its agents analyze code paths in parallel, test hypotheses, and generate concrete proof-of-concept inputs. The company emphasizes that its process aims to avoid theoretical findings by confirming vulnerabilities through execution and producing reproducible inputs that it demonstrates the issue. Of the 21 findings, 8 were assigned CVE identifiers. These included heap buffer overflows, stack overflows, integer overflows, and related memory safety issues across components such as the TS demuxer, dash demuxer, VP9 decoder, image handling code, and FFmpeg option parsing. Several vulnerabilities had existed for long periods, with some introduced as far back as 2003, 2005, or 2010. The article highlights that some of these flaws remained latent for more than two decades before being identified and fixed. The article spends significant time analyzing one vulnerability in FFmpeg's AV1 RTP depacketizer. According to the report, the bug is reachable through a standard RTSP stream and can be triggered with a specially crafted packet. The root cause involves handling of AV1 temporal delimiter OBUs, where an internal output cursor advances without corresponding memory allocation. Because input data is then reinterpreted and written using attacker-controlled values, subsequent writes occur beyond the allocated heap buffer. Depth First explains how the resulting heap buffer overflow can overwrite metadata structures allocated adjacent to the packet buffer, including a function pointer used during memory deallocation. The article walks through the memory layout, allocation behavior, and execution path that ultimately allows control flow to be redirected when the corrupted callback pointer is invoked. Depth First argues that systems ingesting attacker-controlled RTSP streams, such as media pipelines, surveillance systems, and transcoding services, could be exposed because the issue can be triggered during normal stream processing without special configuration. That does sound like a rather technical exploit, and I'm glad the machines are here to do that work for us.
It does a little bit, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Anytime you're doing buffer overflows and trying to take control of memory by segment, I think we're getting into advanced territory, right?
Yeah, here's the thing, Chris. I don't even know what to focus on here. Do we focus on how cheap these guys were able to do this for? Or do we focus on the fact that they found 21 zero-day vulnerabilities in FFmpeg? Which, I mean, I don't know. I find this one to be pretty interesting. I hate to say this. I think this is actually a little bit of a marketing piece. It's not a bad thing. There's not much in here that's like, this is why you must buy Depth First and whatnot. But it's one of those situations where I'm just like, wow, you guys actually did some really cool source code analysis. I would love to see some of the prompts and whatnot that went into pulling this together, right? Looking into FFmpeg's repository, 1.5 million lines of heavily optimized C code dedicated to parsing hundreds of complex media formats. That alone must have been a really, really wild, like, hey, go and, you know, learn about this code base and that kind of stuff. I would have loved to have seen what that process looked like. What I did want to focus on with this article, though, was like just the sheer ability of where we are now in the industry that folks can point an LLM at a code base this large and say, go find vulnerabilities. I know it's much more complicated than that. There's a lot of storage and backend and optimization and stuff that goes into it. But the thing that I want to kind of highlight for everyone here, when we talk about Mythos class level LLMs and capabilities, it's stuff like this. It's the persistence and the digging and the excavation of 1.5 million lines of code and just pressing until the LLM can figure out ways to weave packets and memory structures and corruptions and buffer overflows and whatnot. And that to me is one of the most fascinating points of all this, Chris, and where I think when a lot of people think about Mythos class issues, that's the big concern. It's mm-hmm. pointing an LLM and letting it just chomp through all this data and being like, wow. That was pretty impressive, right? So, you know, with that said, I'm curious to see what the future holds for us. And companies like Depth First or people like Depth First who are, you know, kind of developing these really advanced vulnerability finding modules, I hope it ends up being something that kind of secures the rest of us for the future. I would love this idea of like a zero-day finder when someone deploys a new library or something and it's just like immediately wrapped up and patched. Mm-hmm. It goes both ways. You also have adversaries who are like, that only cost $1,000. I could spend $1,000 to find some vulnerability. So let's hope this gets repurposed for the better.
Yeah, and I really agree with Lima Charlie's CEO, Maxime Lamothe-Brossard, when he said, things are going to get really shitty for a couple of years and then they're going to get better. And I think we're kind of in that area where it's just going to be this, you know, wholesale discovery of all these Latin zero days that have been kicking around for so long. And, you know, a bunch of bad stuff's going to happen and then we'll figure out how to work with it and we'll sort of catch up and hopefully things are stable.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. And I'm in the same boat there with you. I same boat with Maxime, I guess, as well. Which, by the way, hi, Max. Hope all is well. I haven't talked to you in a while. But nonetheless, I hope that that period of how long it sucks is a lot shorter than a lot of us think.
Yeah, yeah. So this next one's really cool. Looks like a score one for the good guys on the fight against software supply chain attacks. Bundler 4.0.13 introduces a new security feature called cooldown, aimed at reducing the impact of software supply chain attacks in the Ruby ecosystem. The feature addresses a common attack pattern where a maintainer account is compromised, a malicious gem version is published, and automated dependency updates quickly pull in the compromised release before anyone has time to notice. With cooldown enabled, Bundler will ignore newly published gems until they have been available for a specific number of days, allowing time for the community to scrutinize before adoption. The feature is optional and works alongside existing security controls rather than replacing them. During dependency resolution, Bundler checks when a gem version was published and filters out releases that fall within the configured waiting period. If a version is older than the cooldown window, it remains eligible for installation. Existing lock files are not affected, so enabling cooldown does not change dependencies that have already been selected and pinned. Instead, it only influences future dependency resolution when projects install or update gems. The recommended deployment model is to define a cooldown policy at the project level so that developers and automated build systems all follow the same rules. Organizations can choose different cooldown periods depending on their risk tolerance. Public dependencies can be delayed by several days while internal package repositories remain exempt, allowing teams to continue releasing and consuming their own software without additional waiting periods. The maintainers also include an explicit override mechanism for situations where waiting is not appropriate. If a critical security vulnerability is disclosed and a patch version is released immediately, developers can temporarily bypass the cooldown policy and install the latest version. The goal is to make delayed adoption the default behavior while still allowing rapid responses when security incidents require immediate action. Bundler also provides visibility into which updates are being held back. When checked for outdated dependencies, developers can see when newer versions exist but remain inside the cooldown window, along with how much longer they will remain unavailable. This helps distinguish between software that is fully up to date and software that is intentionally being delayed under the project's security policy. The Ruby Gems team presents cooldown as one component of a broader effort to strengthen the security of the Ruby package ecosystem. Other initiatives include mandatory two-factor authentication for maintainers, trusted publishing mechanisms, password breach detection, package validation during publication, and AI-assisted vulnerability analysis of widely used gems. Cooldown adds a different layer of protection by slowing the adoption of newly published packages, helping organizations avoid becoming immediate victims of compromised releases while preserving the flexibility to update quickly when necessary. So I love this. It reminds me of when I figured out I could put a 30-second delay on my emails actually getting sent after I hit send, which has saved my bacon more than a few times. I got to tell you, if you don't have that on your email, go turn it on. It's an option in Gmail.
Yeah. I'm going to leave the email one alone. I'm just going to mention and say, in this case, I love this idea, Chris. I love this idea. I love this implementation. I love what happened here. I think that a few other package libraries have done this as well, or at least we're seeing more of them do it. I absolutely love it. We've talked at length in the past few months, maybe year plus, about software supply chain compromises. I was talking with students in my class about it today. One of my students was telling me just how much of a pain point it is for him and his organization to deal with. So anything that helps make this process better, I'm going to be a huge fan of. And I love this point where we see the package maintainers actually lean in with like, hey, what if we inserted a little bit of a delay? What if we created a way for folks to have their finger on the trigger, maybe their finger on the scale of when dependencies get installed, what gets installed, how we handle it, and can we give them any opportunity to delay, to slow down and stuff like that? And man, it would be super, super cool to see that. And sure enough, here we are. We've got this great new feature where they can pin packages, they can insert delays, they can be very, very strategic and careful about what they want to do. I'm just going to say it, Chris, because we're going to be talking about it in the future. I hope that folks don't abuse this and turn it into skip or dangerously skip permissions mode or whatever it's called, where you're just like, you know what, Ruby Gems, just get this thing out of the way. Please, folks, actually use this thing. Actually use this thing and implement it the right way. Please do.
So when you say whatever it's called, does that mean you're not a daily user of the dangerously skip permissions feature, Matt?
It's not that I'm not. I'm not a daily user of it. No. Okay. I was going to say skip dangerous permissions. And then I was in my head like, wait a second, it's actually dangerously skip permissions. No, I am not a user, daily user of dangerously skip permissions, because Chris, do you know what dangerously skip permissions is code word for? It is code word for, I don't care about my wallet. And we don't want any, I don't want to be in that situation is like, you know, why did you spend so much? Because I dangerously skipped permissions. No, there's been a few times. There's been a few times in AI building and development, very similar to this, where kind of like you've used that email delay prompt. There's been times where I've used the plan mode to be like,
how much did this cost?
Yeah, exactly. That's too much. That's too much. Just do step A, and I'll let you know if I actually need the rest.
That's actually not to plug Lima Charlie, although I'm going to plug Lima Charlie, our agentic framework. When you create your agents, you can actually put a budget max for per run. So that's a nice feature when you're building automations, because you don't want absolutely going down the wrong rabbit hole. Yeah.
Is there a Lima Charlie dangerously skip permissions mode?
There is, as a matter of fact, but I think it runs outside of, like, that's in parallel to the budget. So it's gotcha. Just so you don't have to get user feedback for all the different things. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
All right, we might add a YOLO mode now, though, where you just put your credit card in and hit the button. That might be
my way to do it. Goodness. Next thing you know, you just get a bill. And good luck.
Yeah.
Actually, I will admit, folks, and I will give everyone just a little bit of a promotion here. Again, Chris, you've already said it, so I'll say it too. Even if you gave Lima Charlie a YOLO mode, I don't think it would cost that much. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Matt. So next up, I think we've talked about these guys a few times in the last few months. A new variant of the Shah-Hulud supply chain worm known as Miasma briefly disrupted Microsoft's software development ecosystem after compromising dozens of GitHub repositories. According to researchers from Open Source Malware and Step Security, the attack resulted in 73 Microsoft repositories, primarily within the Azure organization, being automatically taken offline for terms of service violations. Although the repositories were restored after review, the disruption had an immediate impact on CI/CD workflows that depended on affected GitHub actions. Because many organizations relied on those actions as part of their deployment pipelines, workflows around the world temporarily failed when their repositories became unavailable. Researchers linked the incident to an earlier compromise involving Microsoft's official Durable Task Python SDK. In May, attackers published malicious versions of the package to PyPy. After obtaining legitimately published credentials, the compromised package reportedly contained a modular intrusion framework capable of stealing credentials and secrets and, in some cases, deploying destructive payloads. Step Security now believes the GitHub repository compromise is part of the same broader campaign and notes that a contributor account associated with the earlier package incident was involved in the newer attacks. Investigators are considering multiple possibilities, including incomplete credential rotation after the first breach or reinfection through the worm self-propagation mechanisms. One of the more notable developments is the malware shift in targeting strategy. Earlier, Shah-Hulud and Miasma campaigns focused heavily on developer credentials and cloud secrets. In the latest wave, researchers found that the malware specifically targeted AI-assisted development environments. The malicious code was designed to harvest credentials from tools such as Claude Code, Gemini CLI, Cursor, and Visual Studio Code. Rather than relying on poison software packages, the attackers embedded malicious configuration files inside the repositories. When a developer opened a compromised repository with one of the affected tools, the malware executed automatically and attempted to steal authentication tokens and other credentials. Researchers believe this shift reflects an effort to bypass traditional supply chain security controls. Most defensive tooling is designed to inspect package registries and installation processes, but these attacks leverage trusted repositories and development tool configurations instead. Simply cloning a repository would not necessarily trigger security alerts, while opening it with an AI coding environment could activate the malicious payload. According to Step Security, this approach allows attackers to operate in areas that many organizations are not yet monitoring closely. Although GitHub's automated systems detected and removed the affected repositories within hours, researchers warn that even a short exposure window can be significant for a self-propagating worm. Any developer who opened a compromised repository during that period may have had credentials harvested, creating opportunities for further compromise and continued propagation. Because the malware spreads through stolen tokens and trusted developer accounts, a single successful compromise can potentially seed additional waves of attacks across the software supply chain. Microsoft stated that it temporarily removed repositories while investigating potentially malicious content and later restored them after review. The company also said it notified a small number of customers who may have downloaded content from the affected repositories and continues to investigate the incident. Meanwhile, security researchers are advising organizations that interacted with the compromised repositories to rotate credentials, review package publishing activity, inspect repositories for suspicious configuration files, and strengthen repository protections to reduce the risk of similar attacks in the future. So that's super sneaky. You know, you go to grab the latest, PR from your buddy that just fixed the thing, and now your machine is spewing this stuff back into the world.
Yeah, that's a little scary for sure. This is one of those situations where we're going to continue to see these Shah-Hulud threat actors or the developers or whoever they are. I'm not even sure what you call them at this point, the worm developers. Well, Chris, they really, really understand like software development and package development kind of approaches and what people do. They're very tuned into from things that people are running automatically and tools and libraries and platforms that are usually being run with very little care and concern. And they're really, really tapping in to those CI/CD workflows and tapping into how developers are doing what they're doing. And I think it's kind of like the perfect scenario for this situation, because for most organizations right now, they're just building, not really double checking what they're doing, downloading stuff, running it. Hey, run this workflow in Claude, do this in ChatGPT, run this with Gemini, so on and so forth. And it's just turning into this like really, really interesting kind of just spaghetti of a bunch of different capabilities and possibilities. And if an adversary can find a way to slip something malicious inside of there, the blast radius is huge. Mm-hmm. You can get 5, 10, 50, 100 developers to run a thing without thinking about it because everyone's updating, everyone's moving so fast. And I don't want to give credit to the adversaries, but they've certainly found a hotbed. They mm-hmm. found a very approachable attack surface that they're finding a lot of success in. And we've been talking about this worm for months now because they continue to pivot around how people do what they do. And one of the things that we always have to appreciate with threat actors is when they understand their victim pool and they pivot accordingly, it makes it tougher for defenders to keep up. And this is one of those situations where very similar, and I'm going to draw a parallel that may or may not make sense to our listeners, but I'll draw it anyways. This is one of those situations where when you read about kind of like the North Korean AI interview hiring things and whatnot, you think to yourself, like, who would ever fall for that? And it's like they understand that marketplace so well that they've developed tools and techniques around how to subvert the most common types of detections. And I feel like this team has done the same thing. They figured out what software supply chain practices look like, where people pay attention, where people don't pay attention, and they've slipped right inside that, that kind of vulnerable space very easily. So defenders, we've got lots of work ahead of us to kind of lock these things down, but fixing processes and subverting trust and whatnot is going to be a critical one.
Yeah, and it's interesting, again, you know, the developer machines have so much access, and I would dare say that developers are a little bit arrogant in thinking that they can't be compromised, which just makes for a very successful target once you penetrate it.
It does. It definitely does.
All right. Last one we got. Interesting. I'm sure some folks heard about this through the socials. Meta says approximately 20,000 Instagram accounts may have been compromised through the abuse of an AI-powered account recovery support system. The incident involved attackers exploiting a flaw in Meta's high-touch support tool, which is designed to help users regain access to locked accounts. According to the company, attackers were able to take control of accounts by manipulating the password reset process and redirecting reset links to email addresses they controlled. Several high-profile accounts were reportedly affected, and some of the compromised accounts were later offered for sale on underground marketplaces. The vulnerability was not in the password reset mechanism itself, but in the verification process surrounding it. Meta explained that users could request a password reset through the support system, but a bug in a separate part of the workflow failed to properly verify that the email address receiving the reset link actually belonged to the account owner. Wah, wah. As a result, attackers could submit an unrelated email address, receive a valid password reset link, and then change the account password. If the targeted account did not have two-factor authentication enabled, the attacker could immediately gain access. Meta discovered the abuses on May 31st and has since disabled the affected support tool while investigating the issue and implementing a fix. The company has also invalidated password reset links generated through the vulnerability and forced password resets on affected accounts. In addition, impacted users have been placed into mandatory security review processes intended to help restore account security and prevent further unauthorized access. The company reported to regulators that as many as 20,225 users could have been affected, although Meta cautioned that the actual number is probably lower. The estimate includes users whose passwords were reset through the support system and whose accounts lacked two-factor authentication. Meta noted that some of those password resets may have been performed by legitimate account owners rather than attackers, meaning the final number of compromised accounts remains uncertain. It's also unclear what information may have been accessed after accounts were taken over. Depending on the account and attacker activity, exposed data could include profile, detail, email addresses, phone numbers, dates of birth, direct messages, post-account activity, and interaction history. While Meta has not confirmed widespread data theft, the company acknowledged that attackers may have had access to any information available within the compromised accounts. Meta says it plans to notify potentially affected users and encourage them to review their account security settings, with particular emphasis on enabling two-factor authentication. The incident serves as another reminder that account recovery mechanisms can become attractive targets for attackers, especially when weakness in identity verification allows them to bypass normal authentication controls and gain access without needing to steal passwords directly. So when I read this, I feel like that was a vibe-coded feature.
I mean, bugs are everywhere. Bugs have been around since before vibe coding, Chris. Come on now.
It seems like a pretty obvious one. I don't know.
I can't disagree with you, but when I read it, the first thing I thought of was AI is still hard, folks.
Yeah,
AI is still hard to implement. Now I'm with you on like, really? Like that seems like a massive, crazy vulnerability that someone should have been able to pick up on. But not going to lie, when I read this article, I started thinking to myself, like, what have I granted access to? And, you know, what type of an inventory and audit have I done of the authorization and permissions that I've granted? And geez, like, is there a chance that I've got something sitting out there with right permissions? And how many other millions of people are in those same boats, in those same buckets? I think the tool was designed with the best of intentions. But unfortunately, I think it was like, hey, we gave it access to things so we can help alleviate this problem of trying to restore Instagram accounts. And someone was like, perfect. And then an adversary came along, and as usual, they're poking at every little bear they can. And they came along with, wait a second, this thing has really cool access into this underlying API. Let's see if we can get it to do a thing. It's a little bit of a silly story. Hat tip to Meta for patching as quickly as they did. But I'm with you in the token of like, really, guys? I mean, you didn't see this one coming? Come on now.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like that should have been caught in the first smoke test. But alas, here we are. You know, it's
here
just
we are.
To show.
Here we are talking about 20,000 accounts.
Yeah. Big companies make mistakes too. So don't feel bad if you shipped a bug last week.
We're all allegedly human.
Yeah, allegedly. All right, Matt, I think we're at the end. I do want to mention to everybody, sadly, this coming Friday, I guess this will have been published already, but you'll hear it next Friday. So the announcement doesn't make much sense, but we are running the last Defender Fridays. It's come full circle. Eric Capuano will be joining us. It will already have happened, and you'll be listening to that episode next week. So again, this announcement doesn't quite make sense, but here we are.
Nonetheless, we will be there. We will be listening in with ears on to hear what's happening and looking kind of a sad, bittersweet moment, Chris. I've been on that show multiple times myself. It's an awesome, awesome thing, and sad to hear it go and see it go, but happy to see that Eric will be there to see it on its way out.
Yeah, it'll be fun. And, you know, what did Neil Young say? Rock and roll is here to stay. It's better to burn out than fade away. So we're
That's
leaving
right.
on top. That's right.
Love it, man. What great, great way to frame it. Awesome. Well, Chris, it's always a pleasure when I get to hang out with you on here.
Yeah, all right, sir. Take care, and we'll talk next week.
Take care. See ya.
Bye. And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.